Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, the City of Columbus has a new department to investigate cases of police misconduct. I'll talk with the new Inspector General for the city. Also, more than 190,000 Columbus children under the age of 18 don't have health insurance. Jay Fox will discuss options through Medicaid and CHIP with an expert. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, the Department of Inspector General in the City of Columbus has a mission of promoting trust and transparency for the community within the Columbus Police Department. The Department of the Inspector General is committed to thoroughly and impartially investigating allegations of misconduct and excessive use of force by sworn personnel within the CPD. And we're lucky today to be joined by the new City of Columbus Inspector General, Jacqueline Hendricks, along with Civilian Police Review Board Chair Brooke Burns. Thank you both so much for joining us today on Columbus Perspective.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Brooke, I'd like to start with you. We've heard a bit in recent years about the Civilian Police Review Board. And as the chair of that board, what can you tell us about what your board has been up to and what the process was of getting the Inspector General's office up and running?
Sure. So I'll step backwards just a little bit and talk a bit about the first kind of inkling into getting a board here in Columbus started with American Thurs Columbus Safety Advisory Commission. There were a number of us. I was also on that commission as well, who took kind of a deep dive look into CPD policies, training, procedures. And one of the recommendations that came from that group was that the City of Columbus have a Civilian Police Review Board. And so from there, that went onto the ballot, and Columbus citizens voted for it, overwhelmingly in favor of having a review board. And then from there, there was a process to apply and have folks kind of vetted, interviewed, and ultimately sworn in by City Council. And so that process itself, I want to say, started around 2017 or 2018, leading up to the creation of the board. And then from there, the board kind of, you know, from scratch, we had to kind of put together what our policies and procedures and practices would look like. We had to kind of set up the bylaws in accordance with the city charter. All in preparation leading to a nationwide search for an inspector general, and then a series of interviews, some of which were like kind of more intimate interviews, and then others which were publicly available. Citizens were able to watch those online, and then ultimately led to the appointment of Inspector General Hendricks and the establishment of the office. So it did not happen overnight. It was definitely a long process to get us started. But now we are, you know, multiple years into this process now, and really proud of kind of the setting up of this work.
So you said it was a national search. Inspector General Hendricks, did you come from far away?
Yes, I am originally from Michigan, the Detroit area.
Okay, well, welcome to Columbus.
Thank you.
And tell me a little bit about your background before you came here. What have you done?
So just a little bit about my background is I am a retired Detroit police sergeant with the Detroit Police Department. I retired after 27 years. Some of the background that's specifically related to why I applied for the job is I worked a special unit called Force Investigations for 8 years. And part of that was investigating uses of force involving officers. So as soon as the incident would occur, we would actually respond right then and there and conduct the investigation, pretty much what similar to what BCI does, involving officer shooting with CPD. But I retired after 27 years with the police department. Then after that, I actually went to work for the Detroit Office of Inspector General, and I was there for 9 years. That's a little different than our office because the Detroit Office of Inspector General, much like the charter, was created by the citizens and they voted. But that office jurisdiction investigate allegations of fraud, waste, abuse, and corruption, and they have jurisdiction over all of the city of Detroit area. But when I was able to, and I really it's an honor to actually have been selected for this position, when I found out about this position and the fact that it focused mostly on police and just trying to build that community, I was interested and applied for the position and just kind of went through all of the steps, to get to where I'm at today.
We're talking today with Inspector General Jacqueline Hendricks and Civilian Police Review Board Chair Brooke Burns from the City of Columbus. The relatively newly created Office of the Inspector General is in existence to promote trust and transparency for the community within the Columbus Police Department. And I'm really interested to ask Inspector General Hendricks, is there a typical day on your job, or what does a typical day at work look like for you?
What I will say is, no day is typical, but what the day looks like when we start is we have an intake person here that comes in, and the first thing is we're reviewing all of the complaints that we get, and we get complaints via our hotline, we get complaints via the email. Some complaints come in either on our main line, and some of them are able to send complaints through, I want to say, during our complaint line. So they're able to do that for our website. It's once we get those complaints, the main thing is listening and trying to just kind of follow up on the information that we're receiving to make sure whether or not that information that we're receiving is enough that would allow us to actually look into the allegation to see if there was police misconduct that was occurred.
When you say police misconduct, what are some examples that you would use that term to classify?
So the main thing that we look at when it comes to police misconduct is anything that officers do that is a violation of CPD policy and procedure and a violation of any city policy and procedure or law. So when we get allegations, for example, if we get a complaint and the complainant is saying that the officer stopped them doing a traffic stop and they didn't believe that the officer had a valid reason to stop them, or if there was a traffic stop and the officer asked them to get out the car and they didn't get out the car, or if there was some type of use of force that occurred where that citizen was arrested, citizens file a complaint to say, hey, were the officer's actions valid? So what we do is we're able to, there's so many tools that we have the ability to look at, which is body cam, police reports, CAD reports. We look at all of that to determine what actually occur. The officer's interviewed, the complainant is interviewed, and then we look at policy and procedure, and we determine whether or not what occurred based on the evidence that we're looking at, did the officer follow policy and procedure? And then based on that, we will produce a report that talks about this is what the allegation is. These are the interview. These are, we interview people. These are the information that we got from the interviews. We prepare a report. We write what our summary and findings are. We put down whatever evidence we looked at, whatever policy we looked at. We prepare that report and we submit that report to the board for the board to be able to review what our findings and recommendations are. And in those reports, we want to make sure that we're letting the board know, hey, this is what the officer did. This is what the policy states that the officer should have done or did do in this instance. And then we let the board know either the officer's actions were in compliance with policies and procedures or they were not in compliance with policies and procedures. And so then we will give the board a recommendation as to whether or not, if they were not within policy and procedure, then we recommend that the board, you know, review it, and we recommend that it is forwarded on to the chief for their review for disciplinary actions in accordance with the FOP contract, because there is a contract out there that officers are disciplined, but it's a discipline, you know, in accordance to what the contract states.
As the chair of the Civilian Police Review Board, Brooke, what message do you have for the citizens of Columbus about the existence of the Office of the Inspector General, and what citizens should know about that?
I think it's really important just for the community to know that we're here and that this matters. This work matters. Part of what gave rise to the board being created in the first place was this sense from community members that there needed to be accountability and transparency. And I think those are two things that the board really does bring to these processes. And so I really think that just raising awareness, the fact that we are here and that folks have a recourse if they feel as though there's something that's happened that they'd like to have some attention drawn to. And so that's really the biggest thing is, you know, wanting the community to know that we exist and that we are available as a resource if there's anything that comes up that they feel rises to the level of a complaint.
And if you do have something to report or a complaint that you'd like explored, you can email the Office of the Inspector General at dig@columbus.gov or call the complaint line at 614-645-9600. Before we finish up, Inspector General Hendricks, what message, if any, do you have for the residents of Columbus about the job that you do?
The main thing what I would love to say is that, you know, we, again, you know, just kind of piggybacking on what the chair said, we want to know that the citizens to know that we are here. We want them to feel that if they have any interactions with the Columbus police officers, that they feel maybe that interaction they felt uncomfortable about, or they felt that the officer did something they disagreed with. We want them to know that they can come and file a complaint. Let us conduct the investigation. At the end of the investigation, we do provide a letter to them to let them know that the investigation was conducted and closed, so that we can offer and provide a solution. I wouldn't say solution, but that we can provide some information for them, so that it's also educating them on what officers are able to do or not able to do. But we definitely want them to know that, you know, we're here, and we want to just make sure that we're kind of bridging that community, that engagement, that education that they may need.
City of Columbus Inspector General Jacqueline Hendricks and Civilian Police Review Board Chair Brooke Burns, I thank you so much for your time today and for giving us this valuable insight. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you wanted to make sure we cover?
You know, what I would like to just touch on is, if it's possible, is that, you know, coming up on October the 19th, we're actually going to be doing a summit. And part of that summit is opening up some classes and some more additional information. We're also inviting some other city leaders to participate. And I think it's going to be a great time for citizens may want to come out and join. We'll also be providing a light breakfast, a light lunch, and they get a chance to get more information and ask more questions about who we are. Our chair will also be there. So I really just like to put that out there.
Wonderful. Where can one go online to get more information about that?
I know we're putting some stuff on here on our website. So we actually have our website, and we also have our own Facebook page that we'll be putting something on, and our Instagram page. So we will be putting it out there, and there will be an invite that'll be sent out for people to be able to log on. I know we have limited space available, so I would encourage people, if they're interested and it goes out there, to actually, you know, chime in and sign in as soon as they can.
Sounds great. We're looking forward to that event. Well, thank you so much for your time today and for joining us here on Columbus Perspective.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
21% of Columbus residents are under the age of 18. That's almost 191,000 kids. And many do not have health insurance. When children have access to routine medical care, they're less likely to miss school. They're able to participate in extracurricular activities and more likely to complete high school and graduate college. As we're now in school mode again, parents, guardians, and caregivers may be able to qualify for free or low-cost health coverage through Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. Kate Guinness is the Senior Policy Advisor for Medicare and Medicaid as it pertains to children's health. And Kate, for those who don't know or may not remember, what are Medicaid and CHIP programs and what's covered under these services?
Thanks, Jay. Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, which I'll refer to as CHIP, offer free or low-cost health coverage for eligible children, teens, and adults. And it covers really a wide range of services, including well child visits, vision care, dental care, immunizations, really all the things that kids need to keep them healthy.
So how do we know who is eligible for these programs? Is it based on income, and what's the threshold?
It is based on income. Each state has Medicaid and CHIP programs that have some differing eligibility, but you can go to find coverage for your family on insurekidsnow.gov for specific enrollment information in Ohio, and you can click on your state. And eligibility generally depends on how many kids are in the family or how many people are in the household. And in most states, children up to age 19 with family income up to $80,000 a year for a family of four may qualify for Medicaid and CHIP.
So why do we feel it is so important for students to have this coverage, other than the things that we mentioned earlier? But why is this urgent right now?
Sure. So we want to make sure that kids stay healthy because healthy kids are ready to learn, and having coverage can improve kids' academic performance, their long-term health, and their future economic success. And really, health coverage for kids benefits everyone. So kids are less likely to miss school due to illness, and really they're going to be less dependent on parents staying home from work if they can get to school. So it also allows kids to stay involved with their after-school activities, clubs, and sports. So we really want to make sure that kids get the coverage and care that they need.
When we talk about the specific services that are particularly important for students, what would you say the number one thing is that students need to pay attention to in their own personal health?
Well, I would say two things, Jay. First of all, I think well child visits, so really those annual physicals, for the littles, it's more than annual, but for most kids, it's once a year. In addition, we know that kids really need a lot of mental and behavioral health services these days. Kids can struggle, and they can get those services covered. Those are covered through Medicaid and CHIP. And we want to make sure that kids can get those services when they need them. And in particular, things like anxiety disorders, depression, and attention issues can impact kids' learning. So we want to make sure that they get the services that they need and that are available under Medicaid and CHIP.
It may or may not come as a shock to those who are listening to this program right now, but drug and alcohol services are also important for students. Is that part of the program?
That is part. And thank you for raising that, Jay, because that is part of the broader mental and behavioral health services that are covered. And there are a range of services, including ones that you could get at your pediatrician's office all the way to emergency rooms or hospitalizations if someone were to need that, which we hope that kids don't need.
Is there a window that people have to register for this, or is it open enrollment at any time?
Medicaid and CHIP have open enrollment at any time, and you can visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW to get the information about the programs in Ohio. And you can walk in, there are online applications, phone applications. So really, we want to make sure that whatever is easiest for families to get coverage for their kids, they can use that means of getting access.
Now, once they have the coverage, do the parents have to reapply every year? How do we keep this going?
I'm glad that you asked that question. So for the most part, kids do need to be renewed every year. A lot of times kids will be renewed automatically, and so parents should keep an eye on the mail, and they might see a form that says you're all set, or they might see a form that says please respond because we need more information. I encourage folks to please respond if they need to. The other thing that is important is if you have moved, you know, people switch addresses if you have moved, make sure that your Medicaid and CHIP office knows that you've moved and has your most up-to-date address so that they can find you when they need to.
The old comedy routine says, on the day you turn 18, your bags will be waiting for you at the front door and welcome to adulthood. But for so many people, that critical time period between the ages of 19 and 24, when they may or may not still be considered quote unquote a student, is a period of instability. What programs are available for people who are in that 19 to 24 gray zone?
So the Medicaid and CHIP programs actually go up to age 19, and so kids would continue to be covered until that age. And if you need to find additional coverage, you can go to insurekidsnow.gov and click on it, and it will help you find the portal for young adults as well as for kids. So that's probably a good one-stop that anybody could go. There is a there is an insurance marketplace as well that they may be able to get coverage through. If they need help paying for it, they might be able to get help paying for it. So I would encourage young adults, probably with their parents' support if they have it, to go there and try to find coverage through the marketplace if they need.
So for the 191,000 kids in Columbus that do not have health insurance, hopefully this has provided some hope and some value for you. We want to thank Kate Guinness for being our guest today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The closeness of the last presidential election drives home the point that every vote does count. As you know, one way to make sure your voice is heard is to vote. Consider this. Ohio's population is a little less than 12 million people. Of those, more than 8 million are registered voters. According to the Secretary of State's office, nearly 6 million Ohioans voted in the 2020 general election. That's a voter turnout of 74%. More than 600,000 voted in Franklin County alone. The presidential race is, of course, the big draw this election, but there are so many other key races and issues on the ballot. The hotly contested U.S. Senate race between incumbent Sherrod Brown and Republican Bernie Moreno, plus congressional, legislative, and state Supreme Court races, the redistricting ballot initiative, and local bonds and levies. Here are some of the important dates to remember leading up to the November election. The deadline to register to vote is October 7th. Early voting begins the next day, October 8th. And then Election Day is November 5th. You can get voter information on the homepage of 10TV.com or VoteOhio.gov. That's the Secretary of State's website. Secretary of State Frank LaRose told me the state is always looking for poll workers. He says they need 30,000 of them across the state to run the election. LaRose also emphasized a couple key election reminders, the voter ID requirements and the registration deadline.
But if you only show up for presidential elections, then the photo ID thing may be a bit new for you. The fact is, you got to have a state government issued or federal issued photo ID. That can be a state driver's license, a state ID, a passport, a military ID like the one I carry. You can get that full list at VoteOhio.gov. You can do your research at VoteOhio.gov as well. Make sure that your voter registration is up to date. That voter registration deadline is October 7th. You've only got until then to update your address, maybe get registered if you're not already, and maybe remind a young person, somebody in your neighborhood that turned 18, maybe one of your own kids or grandkids, that it's time to get registered to vote.
Speaking of that, two organizations working to educate and engage voters are the League of Women Voters of Ohio and the Columbus chapter of the Links Incorporated. Jen Miller is the director of the League of Women Voters in our state, and Davia Stevenson is the chair of National Trends and Services for the Links. Thank you both for being here today.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Davia, first of all, if you could explain to us, what is Links Incorporated?
Yeah, sure. The Links is a premier international women's organization, professional women of color, started about 77 years ago in Philadelphia. Group of friends, nine friends who wanted to do more with their lives, who wanted to affect their communities, transform their communities. The Columbus chapter is one of the heritage chapters. We'll be celebrating our 75th anniversary next year.
1950, right? Yeah.
46 was when it was, when the national organization was founded. And we operate in about five areas: health and human services, services to youth, National Trends and Services, of which I am the chair, the arts, and what am I
International
missing?
International Trends and Services.
Thank you. Come on now. Okay. Did your research.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Thank you, Davia. And
yeah.
Jen, how would you explain what the core mission of the League of Women Voters is?
It's quite easy. Our mission is to make sure that every eligible Ohioan has the tools and knowledge they need to participate in their elections and make their voices heard year-round, including as advocates.
Davia, what has Links been doing to engage with voters, and do you do voter registration drives and such?
We are very much focused on voter registration. Till the deadline, then we'll pivot to at getting people to the polls. But we've got a great partnership with the League of Women Voters, where we've done this poster project. I think you've seen this, that is in the Columbus Public Schools, the libraries, the rec centers, YMCA, and a number of agencies where people are going to be spending time.
Jen, same question to you. What has the League of Women Voters been focused on at this point leading up to the election in terms of engaging with voters? Is it registration drives or is it more education?
It's all of the above. So we have thousands of volunteers across the state, and we love partnerships like the one we have at the Links. We have voter registration drives happening at social service facilities, at colleges across Ohio, many different things in that regard. We also are working a lot on educating people on their rights at the ballot. So making sure that they know their eligibility to vote, that they know how to vote, recruiting poll workers, and many other issues.
We heard we need a lot of them, don't we? Davia, so what are you seeing in terms of interest in this election, and what are the issues maybe people are telling you when you're at these events?
Yeah, there seems to be quite a growing interest. There's a lot of press, right? This election is in the news a lot, and we're trying to reach those voters who may feel somewhat disaffected. So I'm seeing an increase in interest. One of the things I enjoy most with this QR code is talking to people who want to check their registration, who don't know if they've changed, they've moved, or what have you, and they want to engage the process, and they don't know. And so that's been satisfying. In partnership with the League, we've gone to high schools and talked to students who will be turning 18 in time by November 7th, time to vote. And that's an interesting demographic, because they don't understand or believe that their vote has any effect. And so those have been interesting conversations to say, well, you know, it affects what you get for lunch at school. It affects what you study at school. It affects what books you read in the library. Everything about your life is connected in some way to politics, and people don't understand that.
And what are you seeing in terms of voter interest this year? And has it changed since the switch at the top of the Democratic ticket?
Yeah, I do think there's more energy, especially among young people. And so we are seeing, again, a lot of energy, a lot of questions about how to vote. Yeah. So many Ohioans have not voted since the laws have changed. We now have one of the strictest voter IDs requirements in the country. And so we're doing a lot of education to make sure that folks who maybe haven't turned out recently have a voting plan in place so that they can cast their ballot and have their voice heard.
And if they don't have a driver's license or a passport or a military ID, do you kind of emphasize that free
state ID that they can get the picture so that they can have that ID with them?
It depends. So if they're an out-of-state college student and they have an out-of-state driver's license, we don't want them to get a state ID because it will make their out-of-state driver's license invalid. And I think a lot of young people don't realize that that affects insurance and all those things. So it really depends. But yeah, there are many folks that that free state ID is a great option. So yeah, that list, again, because I think it's important to keep reiterating, is an Ohio-issued driver's license or state ID that you get from the BMV, U.S. military ID, U.S. veteran ID, active duty military, including Ohio National Guard, passport, Booker card. One group that I think could be confused is our veterans, because most veterans that I know used to use their county-issued veteran ID. That no longer qualifies.
And Davia, what are some of the barriers, perhaps, that you're hearing about for people who want to vote but maybe find it a little bit challenging?
They don't know where their polling place, where to go for their polling place. As polling places have decreased, there's barriers to transportation. I think people don't know, many don't know who is eligible to vote. If you have a criminal background, when are you eligible? Those types of questions. And then I think apathy was the biggest, honestly, barrier. And that seems to be changing in my encounters.
Apathy, interesting. Apathy. Jen, what is it about, what are the rules when it comes to people with the criminal record? Can a convicted felon vote? We know that they have, you know, challenges getting housing and perhaps a job. Can a convicted felon vote?
Yes. So our laws are pretty good on the books, but not necessarily great in practice because there's so much confusion. Yeah. So anyone who has had a misdemeanor offense or is serving time right now for a misdemeanor can vote. They can vote in jail. Anyone who has served time for a felony can vote. If someone is waiting their sentence, they can vote. If they're out on probation, they can vote. The only time they cannot is if right when they are in prison serving time for the felony sentence. The thing that they need to remember, though, is once they re-enter after serving their felony sentence, they need to re-register.
Okay. And even if they're on parole?
Yes.
They can vote, too. So a few weeks left until the registration deadline hits. Then you mentioned that your focus will switch. Then what will you be looking to do after
that? We'll be looking to make sure people understand where they need to vote, helping them get to their polling places if there's a barrier there. And then, like Jen says, it's a year round. There's a lot of energy certainly around the presidential election, but there are midterms. There are local elections from City Hall to the White House as we need people to understand that engagement in the political process is paramount.
Yeah. I did want to come back to one thing, too. A recent court ruling allows a disabled voter to designate anyone to deliver an absentee ballot for them to the Board of Elections. It basically expanded the list of originally just family members who could do that. How important is that to be able to allow a little extra help for a disabled voter to make sure that their ballot gets counted?
So the court ruling just brought Ohio in compliance with the Federal Voting Rights Act. And so Ohio's law saying that only certain individuals could allow voters with disabilities to return a ballot was not in compliance with federal law. So, and it did have some serious deficiencies. It didn't include grandkids, roommates, caregivers, neighbors. And so this allows voters with disabilities to choose, as the Voting Rights Act says, to choose their helper as long as it's not an employer or an agent of their union.
Are you hearing from people about that yet, as far as asking questions? Maybe, is it okay if I do this way this time around? Because I think you've told me in the past, it's, you know, some of the limitations for folks is maybe they are disabled to the point that they can't put their own ballot into a mailbox or something.
So this or is seal really the envelope. Important. You know, sometimes it's about reading or sealing an envelope or reaching the mailbox or being able to drive. Yeah, absolutely. This is an incredibly important help, because what Ohio did was it made it a felony if you were outside of that list. And that's a concern to think about a grandkid facing a felony just for helping grandma or grandpa return their ballot.
Okay. Real quickly, we only have a few seconds left. Anything you recommend to folks if they want to learn more about this election?
Go to VoteOhio.gov. It's a very accessible website. There are paper ballots. We can do it the old way as well, paper information. The information is available.
And
it
Jen,
is available.
For you, final word?
Vote411.org is our nonpartisan voter guide, mm-hmm. and you can go on there and hear mm-hmm. directly from candidates. Mm-hmm. We don't edit their answers, and you can learn about the issues on the ballot as well. Mm-hmm.
Thank you both so much for being here. Appreciate your time today.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there. And this is what's happening in our country, and it's a shame.
Those words spoken on the presidential debate stage shined an unflattering spotlight on one Ohio city. Former President Donald Trump falsely claimed Haitian immigrants living in the city of Springfield are harming pets. Springfield city leaders say there is no evidence or reports of that happening. The day after those comments, 10TV went to Springfield to find out how state and local leaders, people who live in the city of about 60,000, and the Haitian immigrant community feel about the claims. Governor Mike DeWine and the Springfield city manager say they are focused on meeting the real challenges the city faces, but they also address the rhetoric coming out of the presidential campaign and the debate.
Well, look, this is election season, so, we'll all get through the election and we'll move on.
That's what Governor Mike DeWine said when asked if he was shocked by President Trump repeating the discredited claims about immigrants harming, even eating pets and wildlife in Springfield, Ohio. He said he has full confidence in Clark County leaders.
You know, I think we should take the word of the city manager and the mayor that they've found no credible evidence of that story of Haitians eating pets.
Springfield City Manager Brian Heck released a video statement.
It is disappointing that some of the narrative surrounding our city has been skewed by misinformation circulating on social media and further amplified by political rhetoric in the current highly charged presidential election cycle.
Springfield is being hit by a massive influx of Haitian immigrants in recent years, as many as 15,000. That's led to challenges in the city's schools, healthcare system, and public safety.
While we are experiencing challenges related to the rapid growth of our immigrant population, these challenges are primarily due to the pace of the growth rather than the rumors being reported. These rumors will not distract us from addressing the real strain on our resources.
Heck says while the rapid immigrant population growth has created challenges, it's also created opportunities.
The growth in our workforce population has supported the expansion of local businesses, contributing to the stabilization of our local economy.
The governor announced the state is dedicating $2.5 million to help the city with the challenges in healthcare and public safety.
My job is to focus on helping the people of Springfield deal with the challenges they face.
Ohio Senator and Trump running mate J.D. Vance has also posted about the claims on social media. Governor DeWine says he has not reached out to Vance or the Trump campaign about the rhetoric because this information is already so public. 10TV's Colin Dorsey talked with Springfield residents and a leader of the Haitian community in Springfield who says the rhetoric has stoked fear in the immigrant community.
She's saying there's no truth to the claims.
No.
The head of the Haitian Support Center in Springfield says the rumors are false. Rose Tamar Joseph says she had no idea these claims were going around social media until recently. Now the phone in her office stays busy with calls of people inquiring about the claims. She says even with no evidence, it's brought a lot of unease to her community.
There are fear, a lot of fears going on right now. Some of them are talking about leaving Springfield. Some of them are scared for their life. It's a little bit tough for us.
The debate over the city's Haitian immigrant population dominated the public comment portion of Tuesday night's city commission meeting.
It's sad that there's so many distruths and dishonest comments being made about this population.
We talked with people over the lunch hour downtown. People like John Brown believe the claims are false.
There's been no evidence. And what's frustrating is these people are here just trying to make a living,
do their job.
James Stewart also doesn't believe the claims being passed around about the city's immigrants killing pets and wildlife.
The Haitian community is here. They're going to be here. They're going to start businesses here. However, we do have an issue with the driving. That could be fixed.
He's referring to a string of car crashes attributed to the population, something which has been brought up in previous council meetings. For Rose Tamar Joseph, she's just waiting for the dust to settle.
It shall pass, and maybe in a couple of months, everything will be okay.
The question remains, where did this all start? As Colin Dorsey reports, it appears that it stemmed from a post on a community Facebook page. Then, at the August 27th City Commissioners meeting, a man describing himself as a social media influencer brought up the claims without providing any evidence during the meeting. Another false claim drawing attention to the Haitian community got traction on social media. Video from the Canton, Ohio area shows a woman being arrested, accused of killing and eating a cat in a residential neighborhood. Here's what we actually know about the video. The woman arrested is not a Haitian immigrant, and she was arrested nearly a month ago in Canton, not in Springfield.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.